This past Wednesday, 5-time Grammy-winning country musician Marty Stewart joined us in studio to talk about his latest album, Way Out West, and also to perform a song live. For this week's bonus weekend podcast, we're revisiting three other great live performances we have hosted over the years. In 2009, the one and only Elvis Costello came by to talk about his critically acclaimed music talk show, Spectacle, Elvis Costello With, and he played a few tunes for us. In 2015, the innovative jazz pianist Marcus Roberts played compositions from his album, Romance, Swing, and the Blues. And just last year, award-winning singer and composer Kiran Ahluwalia performed songs from her latest album, Sonata Stillness, backed up by her incredible band. Enjoy.
Swastika tattoo, there is a vacancy waiting in the English voodoo carver. Beef for vandal on the filter boy's head. When it's had enough for that, maybe you'll take him to bed too. Teach him he's alive, or he wishes he was dead.
Elvis Costello is an artist of eclectic tastes. One critic has called him a pop encyclopedia. Over the years, he's collaborated and or performed with the likes of Paul McCartney, Burt Bacharach, Lucinda Williams, George Jones, Tony Bennett, Lee Konitz, Bill Frisell, Ruben Blades, the Brodsky Quartet, and Sophie Van Otter, and, of course, Stephen Colbert. He's written a ballet and a chamber opera. Rolling Stone magazine has included him in the list of the 100 greatest artists of all time, and he's been drawing on those wide-ranging experiences on his one-hour TV music talk show called Spectacle, Elvis Costello With, in which he's interviewed a variety of influential musicians and music lovers ranging from Bill Clinton to Bono. The show, which airs on Wednesdays at 10 p.m. on the Sundance Channel, enters its second season starting December 9th, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Elvis Costello to our show today. Welcome.
Well, and I'm just exhausted after listening to all the stuff I've been up to.
Well, it's been a long career. I mean, it started in the 70s,
yes.
We must admit. And you'll be playing something for us during the show?
Absolutely, yeah.
I've heard that you've been interested in hosting a television show since the 1980s. An interview show? Is that what you always had
in
mind?
Well, no, I did a couple of longer talking shows. I suppose I was being interviewed, and then the discussions opened up on different occasions that I might... Everything from, the BBC are very big on shows about the history of the toothbrush or something like that. They have a lot of programs that are 10 minutes long. And I proposed a show that could have just three songs in it and maybe a song from the catalogue of all the rich songs that exist, a song of my own, and maybe a song I wrote that week, just like a sort of interlude between programs. And it never came to fruition. And then I did host the David Letterman show about 5-6 years ago.
Well, it's one thing to be a guest on a show and be asked
completely
questions.
Different.
It's another thing to interview people. I wonder if this means that I can still entertain hopes of establishing a musical career.
Well, I think anybody can, I mean, I know you obviously have very wide-ranging tastes in music yourself, so I believe everybody has songs within them, and the difference, the advantage I have in doing Spectacle is clearly that... the people coming in know that I, largely speaking, do the same thing as them. The methodology might be utterly different. Our experiences may be different. We may be from different generations. We may have had different levels of success. But they know that I'm not coming in just with a theory about music. I actually know about it practically.
Well, there's the other side. There's always that fear that you can sound too inside.
I think that one of the things that I have to be prepared to do, and I got more comfortable with, is playing the fool. I mean, we don't tape as live. Many chat shows are just taped in real, as if it were going out live.
We are doing a live show.
And we
right
are
now.
Doing a live show right now, and it puts you on your mettle. You know that moment, and if you make a mistake or if you stumble over your words, that lives with you. With Spectacle, we're trying something a little bit different because people are used to telling their story, and therefore I have to play the fool sometimes to settle people into the fact that they can talk at length and we won't cut them off. And then afterwards, we'll work out which are the parts of the conversation that can be best supported and framed by the music that we play on the show, sometimes in collaboration, sometimes intimate performances.
You're famous for your complicated lyrics. Did you feel that even then you were a little too constrained verbally, that you did want to talk about other things?
I never wanted to talk about anything initially. I didn't do any interviews for the first few years of my career. I was more concerned with just getting started, and a lot of the aggression of my early image, as people would call it, was really just down to not wanting to explain, just get on with the job. And after a certain point of time, you do different things that because of the impact of your first work, if you want to not just repeat yourself, then you have to sort of explain why you're taking this turn into something different.
So how does your experience as a musician shape the interviews with other musicians? You have all sorts of insights into
Without sort of just talking about myself all the time, it would be completely coy of me not to be able to say, well, in my experience, this happens. Is that the case for you? That's the best way to put the question sometimes. Because sometimes I can make fun of some things. I mean, when thinking about the riches of Tony Bennett's career and all of the relationships that he has had and his ease with the musical idiom that he inhabits, I was able to play at the beginning of the episode of Spectacle that he was the guest on, an appearance that I made with him in the 1980s with the Count Basie Orchestra. Now, it's an extraordinary thing to me that I appeared on the stage with Count Basie. It was only 6 months before he died. But, of course, I was hopeless at it.
Wait, you sang with the band? Joe Williams, or Tony Bennett?
I sang with Tony Bennett, and it was dreadful. I mean, I was totally petrified. And the clip that we showed me in, like a rabbit in the headlights or whatever animal it is, you know, raccoon in the headlights. And it was funny because people just laughed. It was actually funny to see because you could see that my mortal terror at this. But looking back at it 25 years after, of course, it's a thrilling thing to have this clip, even of me making a terrible hash of singing this song. What an amazing experience. It's just one of those chance things that comes up. And so many of the things I've done have just been opportunities that have been presented to me. They've not been a product of my own ambition. Even this television show, people have suggested me being on television talking about music, and this is the first production that's actually got made. And you know, it's been a very enjoyable experience, 20 shows now we've taped.
And since it has, it's returning for a second season, it's a hit, and Sundance is happy with it.
Well, I guess that must be the case. I mean, they asked for another 7 episodes. It's not the breadth of the first season, but I think given the economic climate, I think we're lucky not to have 3.5 episodes.
Well, you often perform with your guests. I can't do that, but whenever I'm at a loss for words, I ask my guests to perform, so... Mm. what are you going to be playing for us?
Well, here's a song that I wrote when I was about 21.
Wow. So this is from the 1970s.
Yeah, this is from about 1975.
When you were still thinking folk, or
I was playing mostly on my own. I had played in folk clubs, and I played in a little semi-professional band, and I was listening to a lot of American singer-songwriters and. The curious thing is now that I've shared the stage with some of the very people that I was trying to learn from. Like John Prine would be one perfect example, like one of America's. I'd put John Prine up against a lot of book writers as a writer. I mean, he's an incredible lyricist, truthful voice of a singer. And in my own halting way, this was a song that was trying to appropriate his style. Of course, it never comes out like that. And I went back and I thought, well, now all these years have gone by, I don't feel any embarrassment going back to this song and playing it, because contained in it, like a lot of songs written some time ago, the circumstances in the song have come round to haunt us again. The song is really written by somebody who doesn't maybe have the rent money, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was me then.
Do you recognize it as a song that you composed?
Oh, definitely.
Because it's so many years since you wrote it.
And I came back to it and I thought, you know, there's little things in it that I find... are truthful. And there's even a line in it that I later cannibalized and put into a later song, so maybe somebody will spot that if they're really paying attention. Here it goes. Set loose in the nightmare, cast off in my dreams. If home is anywhere that I can hang my hat, then it's coming apart at the seams. My luck is hanging upside down.
I try to hold on tight, but money's rolling out of town and love slips right out of sight. And these bones, they don't look so good to me. Jokers talk and they all disagree. One day soon I will laugh right in the face of the poison moon. You look in the mirror, sorry but it can't be replaced. Sent right out on that cruel parade, buttoned down and laced. Starts like fascination, ends up like a trance. You better use your imagination on some of that magazine romance. And these bones, they don't look so good to me. Jokers talk and they all disagree. One day soon I will laugh right in the face of the poison moon. One day soon I will laugh right in the face of the poison moon.
Elvis Costello. Have you ever recorded that song?
Yeah, I recorded it in my bedroom, and actually it was one of the first songs of mine that was ever played on the radio. There was a radio broadcaster called Charlie Gillett, who's still on the World Service, playing excellent music, and he's a great student of African music and New Orleans music, and I remember hearing Charlie Rich's Feel Like Going Home on that show for the first time, and Dan Penn's Woman Left Lonely, and great songs that I learned a lot from. And he, you know, would encourage people to send in tapes, or maybe people send them in without being encouraged. I can't remember. He also played, I think, played Mark Knopfler's first at recordings, Dire Straits. And I sent my tape in. A drummer in my band had a reel-to-reel tape recorder. I didn't even have a tape recorder. I just had a guitar and recorded about five songs, one of which was on my first album, and the others were in this style. They were this more conversational, lower lion vocally, and they sounded just great in your bedroom, and they sounded great coming on the radio. Imagine what a thrill it was to hear your song when you were just, I was just trying to get started, and I'd sent the tapes round, but you can't imagine anybody, an A&R man, saying, well, we can make this guy a star. And I quickly realized, 77, there was a lot of like energy in the music, and I knew I had to sharpen my writing style a little bit, and the song is about somebody not fitting in. It's not that different lyrically to the songs that I wrote 6 months a year later, the songs on my first record. It's the musical tone that changed, but the little fatalistic sound of the music appeals to me now. I'm quite proud of the song now. I'm glad I didn't forget it.
And the lyrics are quite clever. You were still quite young.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been writing since I was 7 years old. I knew I was a writer before I knew I was a musician. So, I mean, I as soon as I could string words together, I tried to write things that meant something to me. I don't know whether they were of any value. But by the time I got to 21, I had an idea I was doing okay with that, you know.
Well, you grew up in a musical family. Your father was a band leader.
He was a trumpet player.
But he also sang.
He was a singer with a commercial dance band, a big radio dance band in England that was on the radio every week when I was growing up, and was part of a very different way that we heard pop music in England. Not so much radio, there wasn't 24-hour pop radio or anything like that. A lot of it was filtered through the dance band sound. So he had to learn the songs, a song a week, or five songs a week, and I would have access to those song copies and the little advanced recordings.
And he gave you your first professional break. You sang on a commercial with him?
I did. I sang on a Lemonade commercial. First time I was ever in a recording studio, and wasn't much used to me later. And also my first experience of how to lip sync, as you call it. We call it miming. Mm-hmm. I think it's an even better expression. Going along and playing with him in a club in Blackpool in the north of England, and realizing that I had tuned to an organ that wasn't at full power. And when it came up, I couldn't play in the key that we were in, and so just turned down and pretended to play, which was great practice for being on television in the early days, you know.
And you know,
because they never let you play on the BBC, they never let you play music. One of the curious things about doing spectacle is, I've got to do so many things spontaneously, with rough edges, with mistakes, with collaborations that have been put together on the day, to talk to people, some of whom I've admired my whole life, like Smokey Robinson, to sing with Smokey Robinson on the stage of the Apollo, or songwriters whose songs I think are indelible, but nevertheless are not that well known to many people. They will be discovered, and if the spectacle has some part in bringing people to a broader audience, then it's done some kind of good job, I think. You know?
Spectacle is Elvis Costello's show on the Sundance Channel. The second season is about to begin. But the first season is available, just released today, on DVD.
Indeed.
And we're going to take a little break, and we'll play something from the DVD.
Great.
And when we come back, we'll talk more. Elvis Costello singing Shipbuilding, and there's an organ in the background there, but obviously in the right key.
There's also a pretty fine trumpet solo a little bit later on that record by Chet Baker. So that's,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
And Chet Baker recorded one of your songs.
He recorded the song Almost Blue, yeah. That's probably my most covered song now. My wife did it, Donna Krall did it, and there's been a lot of different interesting versions of that song.
Yeah. We're talking about, among other things, the show on Sundance called Spectacle, Elvis Costello With, which airs on Wednesdays at 10 p.m. and begins its second season on December 9th. Mm-hmm. The first season has just been made available on DVD. And, you know, because it's edited, you probably don't have to worry about any embarrassments, or are there still things that slip?
Well, I think the one thing that people come to tape the show must wonder whether I've lost my mind sometimes, because as you probably know from sitting in your chair, you can see sometimes in people's eyes that they're ill ease in the moment of beginning the interview. Well, the advantage when you're not doing it live is that I can sometimes play the fool and go off on a riff that'll never get used in the final show, and that allows them a moment. Because I know from my own experience of performing and talking on interview and performance shows that I've done that might be nothing like Spectacle, that it's quite difficult sometimes to shift gears between performance. The adrenaline that generates means that you don't gather your thoughts so well and talk coherently for a second or two. And we settled down and got into some really good conversations. And the show itself doesn't stay the same from week to week. Some of them, you played a fragment before of us playing with Bono and Edge with the rock and roll band. But the conversation that went between those numbers was very intimate and sometimes very funny. Other shows are, we had a couple of shows, one in season one, where we had Roseanne Cash, Kris Kristofferson, John Mellencamp, and Norah Jones sharing the stage. And the remarks and the exchanges were much briefer. It was on the style of a Nashville guitar pull, where it was past the guitar time. This season, we did the same kind of show with Sheryl Crow, Ron Sexsmith, Nico Case, and a songwriter who I've just adored for 35 years and is made a record this year called Love Filling Station, which is as beautiful in vocally and in its songs as anything he's ever written, and that's Jesse Winchester. Mm. And I couldn't, you know, his first eight bars of his rehearsal had the entire room like in almost in tears. It was such a beautiful sound that he created, you know.
Well, obviously some of the people you bring on are among the most famous in the business, but someone like Jesse Winchester had his moment and then he's kind of disappeared.
Well,
it's important to remind people.
That sounds kind of you know, if I presented it that way, I'd feel as if I was being condescending, but I think that I felt he has been playing and he's been out there performing and he's gone a quieter path. And it's when you meet him, having only met him once before, and when I met him, it was about 1976 or 5, and he came to play in London. And I was just a nervous fan that came up and shook his hand and said, thank you for writing Midnight Bus. And so I used to get out of jail sometimes with songs and when I was doing my little club gigs. And I'd had my own songs, and sometimes a song by somebody else would get you out of a corner. And the same thing happened with Nils Lofgren, who was a guest on the Bruce Springsteen episode. And with Jesse, I just his voice was so extraordinary, such a beautiful sound, and I could only think of one other singer in the world that sounded as intimate as him and confidential, and that would be João Gilberto. So he'd be like the American version of João Gilberto, except his songs are nothing like that. His songs are completely in his own idiom. And the songs that he wrote 35 years ago have stuck with me. I opened the show, the evening, the taping. I sometimes play a song and we don't always get it into the show. Can I play you one now?
Of course.
Play one.
Black dog up and sniffed his plate, steaming on the stove. The kids ain't seen you home all day. You're a gentleman born to roam. Black dog don't believe in sin. Think of where the black dog's been. Think of where he's been today. Have you seen the black dog's teeth? Sharp like a knife. Have you seen them tear upon a throat to take a life? Black dog don't believe in sin. Look at where the black dog's been. Think of where he's been today. I've always had a fear of creatures crying in the dark. And every form of evil seems to bear an evil mark. Black dog don't believe in sin. Think of where the black dog's been. Think of where he been today. A woman lays beside me and my black dog at my feet. She keeps me from my wandering life and he robs me of my sleep. Black dog don't believe in sin. Think of where the black dog's been. Think of where he's been today. I don't know the black dog's name, but I call and he won't come. How'd I ever get this black dog, Lord? I sure never wanted one. Black dog don't believe in sin. Think of where the black dog's been. Think of where he's been today.
Elvis Costello, Black Dog. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When you're singing somebody else's, attracted to someone else's song, thinking about singing it, is it the lyrics?
I think the mood of that song always attracted me. I like the idea, just as it wasn't a life I'd led, but as you get older, you probably have a more experience in writing songs yourself and then returning to them after the heat in which they were written has passed. And you have to inhabit them like an actor would and find a new... Sometimes it's humor. Sometimes you sing a song that was really... might have had some anger or viciousness in it, and the comedy of yourself in that moment might occur to you.
Nothing funny in that song.
Nothing funny in that song, but it's a, you know, it's a decent amount... I was brought up Catholic, decent amount of guilt and dread in it, you know, for me.
You recently wrote an article for Vanity Fair in which you listed your top 500 albums, and the range was was very broad. When I think of your career, you know, you began doing folk music, then you were a pub rocker, a punk rocker, a pop crooner, or at least one magazine review referred to you as such. You performed in an opera. You've done a little bit of pretty much everything. And you were talking earlier about shifting gears. Do you have to think twice about shifting gears when you go from one thing to the other?
Well, none of it is really being generated, oddly enough, by ambition. I don't really have ambition in the conventional sense that I just start off and I end up somewhere. I mean, if you have ambition, you can be thwarted. You can say, well, if I don't, you know, I maybe had some crazy, simplistic ideas about let's go to America and we'll make it, you know, early on. And then when you realize it takes a long time, and it either involves you making yourself notorious or people loving you. And I don't really care for either idea.
You did make yourself notorious first time you appeared on American television.
Yeah, but it's over such a trivial thing. In the long run, I think that just following my natural curiosity about music and perhaps starting in a household that had a lot of music in it and being around a musical background, the jumps that are so sort of horrifying to people who are very literal-minded about music and also horrifying to people who are genuinely the first thing they heard from you and just want that. I can appreciate that. There's all sorts of people that I like. I like one element of their work, and I can understand it, but it isn't going to stop me doing the different things because the experiences are in the long run so worthwhile. And if I had to repeat the same thing over and over again to find this simple formula out of the things I began with, I think I would have stopped long time ago.
Well, you become an oldies act, which unfortunately afflicts too many people.
Yeah, it's a bit dangerous, I find that I've left certain key parts of my musical understanding bare. Like towards the guitar, I'm quite a primitive guitar player, but I can write orchestrations. So I understand how the orchestra works, and I can write it to my own satisfaction. I'm not trying to obey a whole lot of rules by other people. I hear my own sound. I hear my own sounds in terms of rhythms and harmonies. And I just try to... And then these opportunities came my way to collaborate, and sometimes it was with people who I only dreamed of ever meeting. I never even imagined meeting most of them, Burt Bacharach and Alan Toussaint
or George Jones,
any of these people. It was quite beyond my imagining.
So to some degree, and this has been coming across not only in this conversation, but you see it in the TV series, you're a fan on some level, and here you are living out the fan stream. All of your heroes.
The odd thing is that one of the strengths of Spectacle from the first episode with Elton John, who was one of the executive producers, with some collusion, I have to say, I said to him, the Elton John I never see on television when you're interviewed is Elton John, the music fan, who knows so much, who can quote the most obscure entries in the jazz catalog, let alone R&B and all these other musics that he loves. And we chose to celebrate certain singers who he loved, Laura Nero, David Ackles, Leon Russell. And you know, it seemed to encourage subsequent guests to do something similar. In a couple of episodes later, we had Lou Reed, who's, you know, is people's narrow idea of Lou is all governed by the Velvet Underground songs, and they don't hear the breadth of his work. They don't hear there's darkness in there, but there's a lot of soul in there. And for him to hear him talking with great love and admiration about Doc Pomus or Little Jimmy Scott, and so it would go on. Every show, there was the two overriding themes of Spectacle that come from the guests, not from my doing, are the celebration of other people's music. You have Ray LaMontagne, Lyle Lovett, John Prine, and myself. And how do we conclude the show which we shared? We sing a Townes Van Zandt song. Mm. And so it goes on. It's all about celebration.
You had Elton John interview your wife, Diane Krall.
It was a wonderful interview.
You couldn't do that?
I just thought it would be a little coy. I made an appearance. I sang Almost Blue, a song you mentioned earlier on, at the top of the show, and I came out to have a fool around, sing and make him whoopee at the end, just so it went out like a, you know, Frank, Sammy and Liza kind of version.
Well, Elton John says he hates his original name and is happy he changed it. But didn't you after you had your name legally changed to Elvis Costello, have it changed back to your birth name, adding Aloysius as a middle name?
I did add Aloysius, which was a private joke, but I never liked my signature. It wasn't the name I didn't like, it was the signature. I never liked DP. McManus was hard to sign. I'm a lefty, mm-hmm. and I don't write very well. So the flow of the A seemed to carry me into the M. And it was better. But I mean, people read all kinds of psychological reasons into the name changing, but none of it was true. You know, some people think that the name was a dare, and it's worked very well for grabbing people's attention. But I know who I am. I know what family I come from. And Costello is a family name anyway. It's not a name I pulled out of the air.
And in fact, you
it's
said
nothing to do with either Lou or Frank.
But you did say that you took it to some degree as a tribute to your father.
Well, no, it's my great grandmother's name, Costello. Mm-hmm. There's no Elvises in my family, except for me.
People are probably unaware of just how many Italian names there are as part of the British tradition. Mm. They pop up all over the place.
Well, the name is always said as Costello in Ireland, and that's where it comes from, the north of Ireland. But I don't know where it came from before that. Maybe from Italy. I don't know. I can't imagine how it would have got to Dungannon, but maybe it did.
This is that cliche question, but I don't know how to avoid it. Are there people who you would die to have on your show who you haven't been able to get so far?
Well, I think there were one or two people that we narrowly missed. We tried to schedule some people, and we seemed to have they had given us to understand they were interested in doing it, and that's tantalizing because we. But then, given that the second season has now been completed with 7 episodes, not 13. We had less opportunities, and so there were one or two people. But, I mean, just even theorizing some of these shows, you know, sometimes when we first, before we made any shows, we wrote big lists of potential ideas for shows. Like we said, let's have a show on Detroit where we have Iggy Pop and Madonna, and they can arm wrestle, you know. And, you know, of course it's never going to happen. You know, you can theorize these things like crazy. But then you have to think about practicality of what it would be to get everybody there on the day, everybody feeling like they can contribute to it, and it's going to be something they want to do. And, there have been one or two people that I've talked to about the principle of doing the show who haven't ended up doing it, and it's been, you know, I'm relaxed about that just having the conversation with them has been really interesting to me to be able to put the case for the show.
Elvis Costello's TV show, Spectacle Elvis Costello With, begins its second season on the Sundance Channel on December 9th. It is aired on Wednesdays at 10 p.m. And there's a new DVD just released of the first season. We're going to go out with the song that got you in trouble on Saturday Night Live. You suddenly launched into radio and upset all of those producers because they didn't expect it.
Well,
much for spontaneity on Saturday Night Live.
Well, I think that, you know, we could have been singing anything, let's face it. They didn't know what we were singing. But it's something I saw Jimi Hendrix do on television. It was like one of the first times I ever saw television go out of control. You know, you lived in England, so you know that they used to read the news wearing evening dress on the radio. You know,
tuxedos.
So it was very different, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm very pleased that it was radio. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. But everybody else is overwhelmed by indifference and the promise of an early bed.
Let's change it. Instead, it's going to be. Oh, look.
Marcus Roberts is a jazz pianist and composer with a sense of history. In a recent 60 Minutes profile of him, Wynton Marsalis called Mr. Roberts, who's a former member of his group, a fearsome and fearless player. His new 13-piece band, Marcus Roberts and the Modern Jazz Generation, has released its first recording, a double album called Romance, Swing, and the Blues, and they opened a five-night stand at Jazz at Lincoln Center last night. I'm happy to welcome Marcus Roberts, along with bassist Rodney Jordan and drummer Jason Marsalis, back to our show. Hello, it's great to see you again.
Oh, man, great to be here, always.
Now, you're here performing as the Marcus Roberts Trio, but also as members of this 13-piece band?
Exactly. It's like two bands in one.
Who else is in the other group, the enlarged group?
It's a large group. We got a lot of young people that we've all worked with over the years. We do a lot of work at Florida State University. And a lot of the young people that are in the group are, they were students of ours actually at the school. So we've got Etienne Charles, who's building a name for himself, great trumpet player. Alfonso Horn, who is a wonderful young trumpet player as well.
Great name for a trumpet player.
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect name. Ricardo Pascal, who's a very talented young tenor player who we're using. Stephen Riley. I mean, we got a lot of great musicians here. And the feeling in the band is so good. Like, it's, you know, like, folks watch out for each other. There's a lot of solidarity. And it just shows how jazz music can bring people together in a spirit of like civic cooperation and mutual group respect while still stating your own individual goals and beliefs and agendas. I mean, that's what's great about it.
Are there any challenges in playing in a group made up of musicians from different generations?
Well, jazz has a history of that, going all the way back to, you know, Monk worked with Coltrane and mentored
him. And Coleman Hawkins.
Coleman Hawkins, yeah. And, of course, you know, Louis Armstrong was mentored by King Oliver and Fats Waller by James P. Johnson. So there's a history of it, but I think we had kind of gotten away from it. I know when I first came out on the road years ago, like, older musicians would kind of mess over you. I don't know if they were upset that they didn't get the credibility that they felt they deserved or what. But I always vowed if I ever got in a position you know, of some kind of prominence where I could have influence on young musicians, I always said I was not going to treat them like that.
Well, jazz has always had a mentoring aspect.
Always.
So the older musicians help the younger musicians.
Yeah, I think it's a critical part of what makes our music special, because, you know, you're basically taught the rules of the game by the people who helped create it, and then your responsibility is to pass that information on. So I think it just gives our music so much power through that diversity that comes from all these different opinions. But again, the ones from the older musicians are grounded in actual knowledge and understanding and dues that they've paid to the art form.
You're going to play something not by you right now. You're going to play something by Thelonious Monk?
Exactly, because, you know, he was much better than me.
No. Well, he's one of the three great jazz composers, I would say.
Oh, absolutely.
That would be Duke Ellington, Thelonious Monk, and Charles Mingus.
Well, yeah.
And then, of course, comes Marcus Roberts.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
the Marcus Roberts Trio. That is Marcus Roberts on piano, Rodney Jordan on bass, Jason Marsalis on drums, playing. What is the actual name of that tune?
It's called Blues Five Spot. I think he wrote it thinking about the Five Spot where him and Train played.
Well, he played at the Five Spot for many years.
He did,
one of a regular band. Mm-hmm. And that made me smile, and I think that he had to be one of the wittiest composers of all time.
No doubt about it.
But also, I would imagine that part of his appeal for you is that he has such a strong sense of history. At the same time, the people were saying he was very far out. Monk would suddenly break into a stride piano approach.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a famous story of him. Somebody put on one of his records playing solo, and he said, it sounds like James P. Johnson. Mm-hmm. So he loved the history of the music, but he was always, and this is what jazz does. I mean, whether you have that deliberate intention or not, I mean, you're always creating a dialogue and with the past, you know, bringing it into the future through the present, and I think that's what he did. That's why, like, his themes are so melodic, but the rhythm is what blows your mind, like the rhythm. I mean, like, you could take Monk. I mean, Monk could have played in any kind of configuration. I mean, you could have put him in a funk band. You could have put him in a rock band. It wouldn't have mattered, like, because the rhythm is so strong, so American. And his folk themes, I think, are very modern, even in their most simplest form.
You're well known for giving each member of your band equal time for solos, as we saw there. But with a band the size of the modern jazz generation, 13 pieces, how's that possible?
Yeah, I end up working on sets for like hours and hours to try to figure out how to give people equal time, because I do feel like the improvisational part of our music is the most important thing. It's the group improvisation, the give and take, and everybody working within that terrain. Yeah, it is very hard, but somehow we do it. I really don't know, honestly, how we do it, other than I do spend a lot of time throughout the set to make sure that everybody gets some kind of opportunity to express what they can play. But it is a challenge.
And then we have this new recording, Romance, Swing, and the Blues. It kind of covers a range.
Absolutely. And that's why it took two CDs to do. And, of course, those are three huge topics. So I guess we figured we need a little more space and time to cover them. I always tell people, well, if you don't have any romance in your life, and if you're not swinging, and there's no pulse in your life, the one thing you can count on having is some blues.
Were you actually thinking in those terms when you were composing these pieces?
Yeah, because the blues form and swing is how a lot of the, you know, important romantic songs throughout the history of our art form have been developed. You know, they were developed, you know, inside of that. So I just wanted to bring them all together. Romance is like a real relevant topic, and jazz music has as its cornerstones playing the blues and swinging, which Duke Ellington always described as, you know, if you've got two people or more in a room and their pulses hook up, they're swinging. And so that's really how I look at it. Like, swing is not some abstract conception. It's really like a point of agreement between two people, you mm-hmm. know? So at the point where you can get through all the conflict and all of the oppositions that are in our culture and in our civilization, if you can work through all that and find, like, common ground or a shared belief or a common purpose, then to me, that's what swing really is.
But isn't that also what jazz is about? There's a conversation going on between the different players.
Always. Communication
is the key. Are you listening to the bass and the drums while you're improvising your part?
Absolutely. That's what makes it, like, to me, one of the hardest musics to play, because people are making up stuff, and you got to understand what they're playing, figure out a way to make that sound good or better while still figuring out what you're trying to do, and everybody else in the band is doing the same thing.
I'm really amused by the title of the other tune, the next tune you're going to play, Being Attacked by the Blues.
Well, don't you have days where you wake up and that's what you feel like? You wake up, your car won't start, you can't find stuff, or more major events than that go on. So, yeah, the blues are always there, but, yeah, sometimes you do feel attacked by them, and your only antidote to it is find something that brings you peace, and that's what we hope when people hear good jazz. That's what we want to bring to them.
So let's listen to that tune, Being Attacked by the Blues.
By the Blues.
Marcus Roberts Trio with Marcus Roberts on piano, Rodney Jordan on bass, and Jason Marsalis on drums. One, two, one. being attacked by the blues. Marcus Roberts on piano, Rodney Jordan bass, Jason Marsalis on drums. Was that a blues?
It was, but it's a 14-bar blues. It's you know, I always try to manipulate the form a little bit and not do just the conventional 12-bar cycle. So, yeah, it's kind of extended by two measures. But it is a blues. It's different, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thelonious Monk, getting back to him, he did a lot of blues tunes that you have to listen closely to realize they actually are based on the blues.
You do.
And I guess a lot of other musicians have done that as well. But that was about as far off of what I think of as the kind of blues that I can improvise on when I'm walking down the street in my head as I've ever heard.
Well, we kind of played it a little faster. Now, if we were to play it kind of like, look at this tempo, we play it a little slow. One, two.
Yeah, I can hear it there.
So if you slow it down, you know your brain can kind of absorb it and kind of figure out that that's what's going on.
Wasn't last year an especially busy year for you? You recorded the Romance Swing and the Blues, released three other albums, profiled on 60 Minutes, debuted your first ever concerto with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah,
you've been working on that piece for a while, I hear.
Oh my God! Yeah. No, it's been a crazy couple of years.
And what were you hoping to accomplish last year?
Well, what I always want to accomplish is just taking a step closer to expanding our jazz audience and just reaching certain artistic objectives that I have. I mean, I really wanted to get this group with these young people off the ground. I mean, we've all been very inspired by their work and their dedication and their interest in the music. And of course, you know, I'm always writing music, and since Rodney Jordan joined our band in November of 2009, he's also been a tremendous inspiration to both me and Jason. I mean, Jason and I, we've been playing together for over 20 years now, but his fire and dedication to the music, too, has just, I think, helped our productivity a lot, because he's just so serious, and, you know, he teaches extremely well and plays great and a great person. So I just think, just like when you have the energy of a lot of good people working together, I think a lot gets done.
And you're going to be at Dizzy's at Lincoln Center tonight through Sunday?
Yes.
They're going to be the same set each time?
No.
So do you know what they're going to be in advance?
Oh, yeah. It's all yeah, we map it out in advance. Yeah, we got a lot of music. We were talking about that the other day. Like this big band, we have so much music. That's why I felt like it needed to be a band, because all the different projects that we've done over the past 3, 4, 5 years, it's like an unbelievable amount of output. So, no, we have, I don't know how many different sets there are, but it's, you know, they're all very different.
For somebody like you, Rodney, you have to learn an awful lot of different chord changes, don't you?
Absolutely.
Well, we have all the information about this gig at Lincoln Center on our show page at WNYC.org. And people can find the record from J Master Records.
That's right.
Romance, that's right. Swing, and the Blues, Marcus Roberts and the Modern Jazz Generation, a 13-piece band. Well, Count Basie did 16, and so did Duke Ellington. Who's missing?
A couple trombone players, probably.
Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Our pleasure. Always love it.
Marcus Roberts, it. Rodney Jordan, Jason Marsalis. At least they're not missing.
No. We love coming on your show. You actually know the music. coming anytime.
Paul sitting in for Leonard today. Kiran Ahluwalia lets us travel to distant parts of the world with her voice. The talented Indo-Canadian singer-songwriter combines South Asian song, African desert blues, and Western jazz on her latest album, Sonata Stillness, which won the Canadian Folk Music Award for Best World Album. You can hear her tomorrow night at Joe's Pub, where she'll be playing at 7. But in the meantime, as a special treat, she's going to perform right here in our WNYC studios with her band. And it's wonderful to welcome back Kiran Ahluwalia to the Leonard Lopate Show right now. Hi.
Hi, Arun. It's absolutely amazing to be here. Super psyched to entertain you and your listeners.
Oh, I like that. It suddenly reframes this whole thing. You all are facing me and entertaining me. It feels very indulgent. So you just got back from a tour in Canada, am I right?
Yes.
What's it like to go back home?
Oh, it's really great. Nice hometown audience there, and it's nice, yeah.
You weren't born there, but you were raised there, correct?
Yes, I was born in India, brought up in Toronto.
How old were you when you moved over?
I was 9 when I moved to Canada.
Oh, okay, you're fairly old. So you had this real sort of kind of, I guess, socialization or culture, acculturation sort of process that must have happened at that age.
Yeah, it's actually, I read a study, and actually the 9 to like 11 age group is the hardest for immigrating.
Mm.
So it was a pretty hard immigration for me.
That's interesting. I was 10 when my family moved from Texas to India, so I did the opposite thing, but then we moved back. So you're in Toronto, is that right?
Yeah.
And was this a good place to meet Ghazal poets? You're sort of getting into that when you get older. Is that what was happening to you when you were growing up?
Yeah, it was a really, really good place to be with Indian music. The Indian community, when I was there in the 70s, when I was young, the Indian community was small. And so big artists from India would come, but they would perform in basement concerts.
Hmm.
So I got to see a lot of great Indian artists that I wouldn't have seen in India so close up.
Hmm.
And I'd be, as a child, right there in front of them. And at that point, they were doing music like Indian classical music or a type of song form called ghazal, which is beyond really the capacity of a child to understand. But I was, even at that age, mesmerized by that, those kinds of melodies. And so I was just glued to them.
So, I mean, for those who don't know, I mean, how would you describe the ghazal?
A ghazal is a lament. It's a lament about not being united with your beloved, not being united with any kind of passion that you have. And so that is, my training is ghazal. But what I sing right now, of course, is modern song. It's not ghazal, but that was my training.
I mean, this is something that you probably didn't really quite expect, to move from somebody who's, you know, going to do some sort of professional job to becoming a full-time musician, right? This is not something that you ever planned on being.
Absolutely.
And how did that come about exactly?
The last thing I did in terms of studies was an MBA in finance, and then I worked on Toronto's Wall Street, which is called Bay Street, and I was trading bonds, and I was absolutely horrible. I had skin rashes all over my body. I was super stressed, didn't like it. I was making money, but I didn't like it. And so I finally, after 6 months, left that didn't know what to do, and a dancer heard that I wasn't working, and so she hired me for a national tour in Canada to sing. And then other people heard that I was available, and so, you know, like that, just started.
So we're going to hear you play one of your songs soon, but first, do you have a hard time categorizing the music that you play?
Absolutely. It's really hard to categorize because it's a mix of so many different things, and it's a mix of pretty specific things. So it's not Indian classical. It's not ghazal, which are my training. It's modern Indian song, and then it's got this very big influence from the African desert blues from the Sahara, and then it's got an influence of jazz and intricate jazz harmonies and harmonies from Western classical music. And so it's a real, real big load of words. And so the thing that I've started with now is I'm calling it Indian fusion. Yeah, it's not 70s fusion, but it's modern Indian fusion.
That's where you're at right now.
If you ask me a week from now, it might change, but that's it for now.
So let's hear something. What are you going to play for us right now?
This is Janina, and this is a song about not an external enemy, but an internal enemy. It's a song about that self-sabotaging part of my brain, and it's about entering that little corner in your head that has a door, that has a sign that says, do not enter. And it's about breaking down that door and fighting a civil war with yourself and winning.
Let's hear it.
Janina, 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 koi. Janina, 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 koi. Janina. मेरे अंदर एक कमरा है मेरे अंदर एक कमरा है जिसके दरवाजे पे लिखा है
कमरा है जैसे
or something I should be like sipping on. Listen to this. Now, one of your band members, Rez Abbasi, is a jazz guitarist in his own right, sitting here. He has a special connection to you. You guys are married, am I right?
Yes. So far.
So far.
Okay, you actually good. Heard jazz in that piece?
I will not label. So what's it like to be married to the band?
Well, it's actually pretty awesome. When I met Rez... Before I met Rez, about, 13 years ago, I was...
Who's counting?
I was ready to kill my guitar player.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I was almost ready to quit music. I thought, I cannot tour like this. And then I met Rez, and he entered my life, and we started touring together. And honestly, he made it possible for me to continue touring. And it's there's so much music that... gets born because we live together and because we are in such close proximity to each other. One of my favorite tunes, I was rehearsing it and rehearsing it, and I just thought it was, oh, this is too difficult, I can't do it. And after a couple of months, I'd stopped doing it, and Rez said, well, why have you stopped that tune? That's a really good tune. And so because he had heard me doing it and he encouraged me to keep on doing it, I went on. Other times he's just, you know, on the sofa noodling with his guitar, not knowing what he's
doing.
Too
much information.
Not knowing what he's doing. And he'll play a couple of chords and I'll just fall in love with them and I'll grab my phone and record them and then I'll compose a melody to those chords.
And you guys don't have like these passive aggressive moments where the band has to intervene and like interpret what's really happening in the relationship and the lyrics and how they speak to some darker truth.
Honestly,
we had one about 10 minutes ago.
Honestly, you know, when we were sound checking, I think the band, they're like children, like when mommy and daddy are fighting. I think they're just all thinking, oh God, I hope that wasn't my fault that they're fighting. But no, I mean, not yet. I mean, yeah, sure, we do have arguments. But I think the trick is that we just make up really fast. We let it go really fast.
You play it off.
A lot of experience.
Perform it off. The title of the album, Sonata, Stillness, what? Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Sonata means, for lack of a better word, it means stillness, but not just any ordinary peaceful stillness. It means like a deafening, destructive kind of a stillness. And there's a song on the album called Sonata, and I wrote that song when I was feeling this kind of destructive numbness and stillness inside me. And so basically it's a breakup song, Sonata, for when I was breaking up with a guy a long time ago.
So why don't we hear another song now? What are you going to play now?
We're going to do a song from our album, Am Zameen, Common Ground, and this is called Rabbaru. And this song is about asking your beloved for not just one lifetime together, but seven lifetimes together. Seven lifetimes, seven engagement rings, seven parties.
Let's hear it.
Mera saath hi sada, mere saath rakhiyo, mere
you guys, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
I like it when you sing for me. It's the way it should be.
Yes, anytime.
Really? Okay.
I'm really blessed to have a wonderful, wonderful group of musicians with me. Can I just mention their names?
Do it.
On accordion is Will Haldhauser. On guitar, as you know, Reza Bassi. On tabla is Nitin Mitta. And on bass, Chris Terry.
So, Kieran, I think you've said that your music with Rez and others here, it could only exist in the diaspora. Mm-hmm. Is that something you said? And what does it mean?
That means that even though I was brought up in Canada and Rez was brought up in America, I was born in India and Rez was born in Pakistan. And these are warring nations. They were one nation. And when the British left India 69 years ago, India got divided into two countries, Pakistan and India, and they have never gotten along. They've been warring, and it was really the loss of a brotherhood that still resonates with us, with our generation. And so our parents were little children when India and Pakistan got divided, and it was one of the bloodiest, it was the bloodiest partition and the biggest land migration known to mankind. Millions and millions of people were displaced. There was bloodshed everywhere. Trains would come from Pakistan and they would come into an Indian railway station and there would be relatives waiting, but all they would find on the entire train were dead bodies. It was horrible. My parents lived through this as children. His parents lived through this as children. And there's still a lot of animosity between the two nations. But when I met Rez, there was no animosity with our parents. Even though our parents had been brought up in partition, lived through partition, they didn't shed that hatred. They didn't pass the hatred for the other country down to us. So I didn't have any preconceived notions of the other side being a bad entity, and neither did he. And so when we met, it wasn't a Bollywood kind of story where there's a lot of like family feuding or anything. Our parents were very open. They loved each other. They loved both of us respectively. And our love was allowed to flourish. And this is something that could have only happened with the both of us living outside of India and Pakistan in the diaspora. If I lived in India and he lived in Pakistan, we would have probably never met. And if we met, it would have been very difficult to be together, both intimately and also musically.
Kieran Ahluwalia and her band will be performing live at Joe's Pub tomorrow night at 7 p.m.?
Yes.
For more information and tickets, visit wnyc.org/lopate. Kieran's latest album is called Sonata Stillness. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for having us.
And up next, director Rob Reiner joins us to discuss his latest film, Being Charlie, inspired by his son's struggles with drug addiction. I'm Arun Vanagopal, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and wnyc.org.